Where did you learn your money skills? How would you rate yourself in terms of managing your money? This hour, teaching financial literacy. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Iowa Core Education Standards require students to learn financial literacy as part of so-called 21st century skills. We start off this hour with what is taught to kids today and the role parents should play. Then, the difference managing money well can make over a lifetime and the common blind spots in financial literacy. What do you wish you'd been taught about money management earlier in your life? Join our conversation. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Do you consider yourself financially literate? What does that mean, anyway, to be financially literate? And what are the best ways to teach financial literacy to our youth? And what do we do if we find out as adults that, well, we're not just very good at managing our financial affairs? We wish we would be better. What do we do in that case? This hour is all about financial literacy, from the youth stage through college into adulthood. I want to have you join our conversation this hour. Perhaps you can chip in what you wish you had been taught about money management earlier in your life, perhaps something you're really concentrating on communicating to your children or your grandchildren. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us to Iowa Public Radio at IPR Talk. Joining us, first of all, Bob Mantell, director of something called the TS Institute. That's in Trainer, Iowa. It's affiliated with the Trainer State Bank, Trainer in western Iowa, just east of Council Bluffs, a town of about 1,000, I think. Bob, is that right?
That is correct. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. So we're tying this into the Iowa Core Education Standards, requiring students to learn financial literacy as a part of a so-called 21st century skill set. Now, several years ago, you looked at the Iowa Core and this requirement here. What did you do there in Trainer?
Our organization, we created a program here in our local community to try to adhere to the state standards in our local school districts. So what I did was I worked with the standards as they exist and developed a program for the students here in Trainer, kindergarten through 12th grade, in order to expose them, you know, to those necessary skills, honestly, so that they would be better prepared to succeed as adults.
Mm-hmm. Spell out those standards. What are the hurdles you're making sure your youth in Trainer can carry themselves across?
Yep. So at the elementary level, we're talking about basic needs and wants, you know, trying to discern the difference. We talk a little bit about creating budgets, at least again on a very elementary level. We talk about some concepts of credit. We talk about opportunity costs, scarcity. We dive in, honestly, even into a little bit of an investment portfolio. So we start talking about that at an elementary level. And then as the kids get through the elementary school, K-5, we graduate into more complex concepts with those same basic premises at the middle school and then culminate at the high school. And then we have some in-school banking programs that serve as kind of capstone lab-type environments to allow those kids to practice some.
Tell us more about these in-school banks, because I think they're really interesting. I sure did not have one in my elementary or middle school or high school. What do they look like? How do they work?
Yep. So with our elementary school banking programs, we have youngsters serve as student tellers at the highest level in which they might be an elementary student. Most of the time it's a fifth grader. We have a number of them serve in a teller capacity. And then we encourage the students to participate, whether they would have an account with our financial institution or not. They have an opportunity one day a week to come in and participate in a savings program. and they receive incentives based upon the various levels of savings that they achieve. So really what we're trying to do is get these students to create savings habits, and then hopefully they'll carry that on, you know, throughout their lives.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that you have some students, I mean, families are all different. Some kids are coming from families that have very good saving habits, and the other families not so good saving habits. So this is a way perhaps to get a child who doesn't have any saving habits, or the family doesn't have any saving habits, to sort of what, reintroduce it to the entire family even maybe.
Yeah, that's our hope, is that, you know, for those who haven't had that exposure, we can introduce it. And for those who have, we can reinforce that habit. We also have a high school banking program that's a bit different. We offer a savings component, but we also offer a checking component and have an on-site teller machine. The intent there is to try to introduce banking to a largely unbanked population. So, and we think we've been pretty successful to date doing that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned investment skills, learning about investments even in elementary school. So how do you approach it at that age?
Mm-hmm. We facilitate after-school stock market clubs for elementary and middle school students as well. We introduce them to the stock market. They play a game with virtual money. They form teams, create virtual portfolios, do bona fide research just like a traditional investor would do. And it's a fun, competitive type of environment, so they're learning about the market, but yet they're also, you know, having fun doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've had a real roller coaster on the markets in the last few days. a learning experience for the kids there too?
Absolutely. We do a pre and a post test with them. We find that their knowledge, generally 25 to 30 basis point improvement with the ramp up having participated in the program.
Mm-hmm. So how many kids in Trainer participate in the banking and in this whole program?
Sure. In our school, every student is exposed to financial education throughout the course of the school year. So there's about 800 students in Trainer K-12. All of them have exposure either through classroom lessons, through our in-school banking, or through our after-school programming. So, you know, we feel fortunate that we're, you know, equipping these kids in that fashion. In our elementary banking program, we have about 65% of the student body that participates on a fairly regular basis. And then with our after-school investment clubs, we average 150 to 200 students a year on that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a figure as how much savings you have in total from all these students?
Yeah, we started our savings program in Trainer. This will be our sixth year having the elementary program. At the end of last year, we had about $80,000 saved over five school years, which is really quite
not
quite,
bad.
Quite
yes,
exceptional.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Where did you get this idea to have in-school banks?
Sure. We're fairly close to the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and they have a Center for Economic Education at their university. And I was able to gain some of their knowledge, and they'd had a model program in Omaha that we were able to study, and then we attempted to make it our own. You know, we tweaked it a bit, but really it was their initial idea.
Mm-hmm. What are the biggest things you learned along the way since introducing this a few years ago?
That banking is obviously important, and it's something that a youngster should learn. You know, and it's really a great opportunity for them to practice their skill. Also, to our primary goal is to really form that savings habit and or reinforce it if it already exists. So, I mean, although we have incentives in place and we certainly want kids to achieve them, the ultimate goal for us is to see them on a frequent basis so that they can reinforce that habit.
What do you expect from parents in this picture?
That's a great question. We've been very fortunate that we've had great parental support of our program over the past 6 years. They're very involved. They really understand the importance of this. And I think that they see that we provide another avenue to teach this. I think that there's a common misperception that maybe educators think that financial literacy is taught at home, and I think parents think that it's taught in the schools, and quite frankly, there's a big gap there. So we think that we kind of fill that niche a little bit, but the parents are tremendously supportive of what we're doing.
Mm. I wonder if you give tips to parents as well, if you could tell us, you know, for parents listening that don't really have a great dialogue or aren't communicating much about money, what are the key things to communicate to your child as a parent?
Well, I mean, I would say the first and foremost thing is to have open communication. I think that for the longest time, having money discussions at home has been kind of an off-limits type of thing, or, you know, there was a perception that that was the case. And I really think that, you know, young people will learn the most by having those conversations at home, to talk about family finances, to talk about if a budget exists, what that looks like. If mom and dad do invest, if they have portfolios, to maybe share those kinds of pieces of information with their students, because it will certainly help give them perspective. What we run into when we teach youngsters is, in most cases, a lot of this content is very theoretical. And until they get older, they don't have an opportunity to practically apply it. So we think that if parents give them that opportunity and have those discussions, it provides greater relevance to the content.
Do you see out there, you must encounter mistakes that parents make with their children in making money relevant, something that has to be taken seriously and gradually introducing them to these skills. What are some common mistakes you see?
I think that the very basic concept of understanding a need versus a want is a big issue that we run into, especially with young people. I think that they, I mean, as fundamental as most people might believe that to be, I think that many youngsters just quite don't grasp that. And
many adults. So what is the difference? How do you say, okay, I've got this, I want this.
Sure.
Is it a need or a want?
Yeah, right. You know, and honestly, I mean, I think that's a big issue. I mean, not only for kids, but for society, you know, as a whole. And I think that honestly, that's one of the bigger challenges we have, is when we talk about the very basic differences, you know, a need being something that you really have to have to survive, and a want being everything other than that. You know, but again, that's a challenge, and sometimes we have to kind of reprogram the youngsters, if you will, to get them to have a better understanding. And then also, when we talk with high school kids, we have a lot of discussions with them in regards to, you know, taking out the appropriate amount of debt load for college. And I know that may be a topic for down the road, but that's a big deal. Again, a lot of young people don't understand that, you know, again, they need to take out what it is that they in fact need, and not necessarily what they want.
Right, right. It's a huge, huge deal in the last few years, really a generational difference in terms of the college debt we had in previous generations, and now students going through college with tens of thousands of college debt when they come out, and they're burdened with it for decades, if not for the rest of their lives.
Exactly. In fact, I can share with you very briefly a coworker of mine. He came out of college with an extremely high debt load, and you know, he understands he'll be paying that off until he's well into his 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty significant commitment.
Bob Mantell is with us, director of the TS Institute. This is in Trainer, Iowa, affiliated with the Trainer State Bank, teaching their youth through the school system through things like in-school banks, financial literacy. Trainer in Western Iowa, just east of Council Bluffs. Bob, before we say goodbye, you were at a summit, at the Governor's Summit, Financial Literacy Summit in May. Tell us what you found there.
Yeah, I honestly, I think it was a tremendous event, and I applaud the Department of Education for creating it. I think it's a huge win for Iowans in general, because it reinforces the fact that the Department of Education understands the significance of financial literacy and the importance of it, you know, being taught in Iowa's classrooms. So I think there was a ton of terrific content that was shared with educators. I certainly think it's a step in the right direction, because, you know, we still have a long ways to go, but I think that, you know, teachers and the people who make the decisions in Des Moines certainly get it, and they recognize that, you know, if we're going to make an impact with youngsters, you know, we need to start doing these things.
What were the specific needs you heard discussed that were identified and said, this is the top of our priority list in terms of increasing financial literacy in our population?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there were a number of different topics that were top of mind. I mean, I think understanding proper credit was a huge thing that was talked about. I think that understanding the budgeting process was a big thing that was talked about. Again, needs versus wants were big issues. investing properly, insurance,
mm-hmm.
Lots of different topics, all of which are very relevant and, of course, you know, are important for young people to understand.
Right. And when we talk about insurance or investing things, we are bombarded with all kinds of, well, that can be in our mailbox, it can be on our smartphone, it can be on the websites that we're looking at. So we have to find a way to become financially literate while being in a consumer society, a capitalistic society where we're being told, perhaps not by the best sources, this is what you need to do with your money, this is the insurance you have to buy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so do you think, when we look at what's happening in Trainer, Iowa with the TS Institute, what is the sense you get of how you measure up to what other communities are doing in their schools?
Yeah, you know, I'd like to think that we're on the forefront of this. You know, we've dedicated resources for this very cause. You know, we've been fortunate enough to work with a number of school districts in our region, and we've been doing some outreach with other financial institutions in the state to try to help share best practices wherever we can. You know, I do know that there are a lot of other community banks and credit unions that share similar desires to help in their communities, and I also know that there's a lot of schools who really understand the relevance and importance of it, but I do think a lot of people need help in terms of identifying the right, you know, resources and you know, getting the right tools in place to best teach this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are your favorite resources before we say goodbye?
Yeah, a couple of them. So I think Junior Achievement is really terrific. They have a tremendous program, and they're based, they have a nationwide presence, but we work a lot with the Junior Achievement organization in Central Iowa. EverFi is a terrific high school program that we use. We use a program called Money Island that's really a terrific gaming-type program for middle school students. And then we're really big on a curriculum called Take Charge Today through the University of Arizona. We think those are really tremendous resources.
Okay, Bob Mantell, thanks for joining us, director of the TS Institute in Trainer, Iowa. We appreciate you sharing what's going on there in Trainer with financial literacy.
My pleasure.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're talking about financial literacy through a lifetime this hour there with Bob discussing how we're educating young people, or should be, in all the skills we need to have to, well, really make a better life. And it's not just about having money. It's about getting rid of stress. Do you know how all of us know how stressful it is to not deal with money well, to have little money, to not know what to do with money or a lack of money? We want to have you share your story. Perhaps you have a wish of something you had been taught about money management early in your life that maybe you had to have a hard lesson later on in life to make it real to you. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You can also write us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Perhaps you just have a good old-fashioned money problem you can't find your way out of. We would field that this hour as well. 1-866-780-9100. Joining us now, Jonathan Fox, director of the Financial Counseling Clinic at Iowa State University, also the Ruth Whipp Sherwin Professor in Human Development and Family Studies at ISU. Jonathan Fox, hello. Jonathan Fox, are you there? Okay.
Hello.
Hi. Hello, Jonathan. We finally got you connected. Sorry about that difficulty, but thank you for joining us from our studio in Ames.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I understand you've taught in the area of financial literacy for some decades here, and you have this clinic at Iowa State University, the Financial Counseling Clinic. Tell us about the clinic and what you focus on when we get to the college age.
Terrific. Thank you. The Financial Counseling Clinic is very much, it's very similar to what Bob was describing with the banking component of his program. And it's critical as we are training financial planners in the College of Human Sciences for them to really practice what we're preaching. And the Financial Counseling Clinic is that learning laboratory, and really a research laboratory also, for us to do the best job that we can in training future financial professionals, those that are going to be working and walking hand in hand through the life cycle with individuals as they pursue a career in helping others with their finances. And we use that so that we simulate as best as possible, real-world situations where our students get to walk the walk and talk the talk of individuals' personal finances. Mm-hmm. And we're really, really lucky to have a state-of-the-art facility in here at ISU where we get to treat it like a real teaching laboratory, observations from behind the glass. There's recording opportunities, and it's the first in the nation type facility. Was established in 1986, but then benefited from a real significant upgrade around 2000 in terms of the facilities.
So the picture I'm getting, Jonathan mm-hmm. Fox, is that you're treating, you have sort of doctors of finance there, if I can put it that way, and you have clients come in with various scenarios. You're talking about recording and glass in between them that you can see, okay, when presented with this situation, you want to train people how best to respond and how to help others.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's very much embedded with our academic program that's just become CFP certified, which is the sort of the gold standard in the credentialing process for financial professionals and those who are calling themselves financial planners. And we're just trying to do the very best that we can to give them the comprehensive tools that they're going to need to be able to work with others. And oftentimes we are, I'm asked the question, doesn't that fit a little bit better in a business college? We're actually, as I mentioned, in human sciences, and I'm in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies. And I would contend that the training that really focuses on the family communication issues, the personal issues related to the finances are equally important to balance out some of those challenges that we face. Mm-hmm. Behavior control and habit formation has a lot more to do with the individual person and their personality than it does actually with the specifics of the financial tools that you might find in a less personality-based business program.
Mm-hmm. So just like a scheme of exercise, you want to become fit. You may know how to do that, but unless you have the self-control to build your muscles, so we're talking about building mental muscles of self-control, for instance.
That's exactly it. And most of the research, and this is a very young field for finding out what's the best way to develop a financially knowledgeable, the term that gets used more is a financially capable person. But the strongest factors in that, and of course, it takes everything. It takes parenting. It takes market conditions. It obviously, a critical, necessary condition is knowledge, but in the earlier research, it's you nailed it. It's the self-control component, and it's those personality factors that we're seeing to have the strongest impact. And the good news is those muscles can be built, and if they atrophy a little bit, we can get back on track. But it goes back to what Bob was talking about having supportive programming, about having supportive things for us to do in our financial lives to build those muscles and reinforce things that are working against us.
Jonathan Fox is with us. He'll stay with us into the next half hour as well. Director of the Financial Counseling Clinic at Iowa State University, training students to deal with financial problems to help others. And we'd like to have you join our conversation. And when we come back, we'll talk more about it and talk about teaching financial literacy or teaching people to be financially capable, as Jonathan used that term, later in life. What do you wish you had been taught about money management earlier in your life? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, our email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Midstream in River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad to have you with us over the noon hour, teaching and learning financial literacy, or in other words, how to be a financially capable person. With us, Jonathan Fox, director of the Financial Counseling Clinic at Iowa State University, and he's taught in this area for couple of decades, and a lot of research he's done. Perhaps we'll get to having him tell us about that a little bit, but we're learning about common mistakes and things that many of us need to get better at when it comes to managing our money. We want to have you join our conversation. What do you wish you had been taught about money management and finances earlier in your life? 1-866-780-9100. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook. We'll get to those calls and social media in just a moment. Jonathan Fox, you know, I have a feeling, see if this is true, one of the big problems is a lot of people, certainly people in your program, really get into financial planning, like it, like crunching numbers, planning, but a lot of people just, it isn't their thing. They will procrastinate, they will put it off, they find it stressful, they just don't like to do it. How do you tackle that problem?
Well, very true, and probably, you know, right from the youngest age, we unfortunately or appropriately get categorized to be either a numbers person or a words person. But at least from our program's perspective, we work with that. And that's why the financial services industry exists and should exist. They're there to help us. That's very much the way that our training is based. And if it's not something that you enjoy and are passionate about, then it's probably something that you should get a little bit of help with. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we all have the need and the obligation to be reasonably engaged. And the starting concepts are really very simple. I constantly use the analogy of weight loss or exercise, and we all pretty much know what it is that we need to do to get started with that. Certainly, there are many more advanced techniques where we could get a lot of help from a personal trainer. It's very similar in the regarding our personal finances. Mm-hmm. We know to get started, we got to do something really simple, like not spend all of our money. but it goes back to the self-control issue that we talked before. There are many forces working against us, not the least of which are the internal forces in our personality and the impulsivity that is stronger in some of us that works against us and aren't able to do the simple things that we know that we should do. So it becomes as much about or even more about habit formation and having components that reinforce those positive habits.
Jonathan Fox is with us of Iowa State University's Financial Counseling Clinic, talking about becoming financially capable people, being financially literate this hour. Barb Wolin is with us as well. She's also at Iowa State University as a human sciences specialist in family finance, also with ISU Extension and Outreach. Barb, we're reaching you in Webster City, I understand. Welcome to the program.
That's correct. Thank you.
So who reaches out to you? What are you dealing with?
Well, as one of, and in case everybody out there isn't familiar with Extension, we're the outreach arm of the university. There's an office in every one of our counties, and the College of Agriculture, the College of Human Sciences, many of the colleges at ISU have connectors, people like me who are educators who work in the field to bring practical, non-commercial, research-based information to the people of the state. But there are 11 of us in the state family finance specialists, so we aren't everywhere, but we serve all the counties nonetheless. And as a result, we get some questions. We also work pretty hard proactively. We aren't doing as much reactively as we are working proactively to get connected with partners who can help us reach audiences, and to work with our county extension offices to provide programming to the public or to pre-existing audiences that will help folks become more financially capable, as you have been talking about already.
Mm-hmm. So you have many, you're targeting adults who are falling short in one or more categories of financial literacy. What are the most common problems you see by the time a person gets past college, 30s, 40s, 50s?
Well, you know, I don't actually like to characterize it that way, Ben. I don't like to necessarily characterize it that we're targeting folks who are falling short. I think it's clear that nobody's perfect. I teach this stuff, and I'm still not perfect in my finances. Everybody has ways we can improve. Our focus is on people who who have a goal they want to achieve and want to work towards that goal, or who want to make sure they're up to date on the information they need. So it's not necessarily that we respond to people with a particular problem. In fact, in general, when someone calls us and has a they've got too much debt, they've got a debt problem,
mm-hmm.
after some conversation, we'll usually refer them to a local nonprofit consumer credit counseling agency who can actually provide service. Since we provide education, we work to bring practical, non-commercial, research-based programs that have been shown to have some impact on the people who participate in them. So we provide that kind of programming.
Give me an example of your most successful program, your most successful tool to improve people's lives.
Well, I'll give you an example of one. I can't swear that it's the most successful. It's a good
sure.
one, though. We have a series called Money Talk. It's a series of 5 sessions. It came out of a historical program that was developed by another organization, and then they discontinued it, and we felt, there's still a need for that. And it came targeted towards women. So it was a series of 5 sessions targeting financial basics, cash flow, month-to-month management, and then insurance, investing, retirement planning, and having all your legal affairs, legal documents in order. So really a nice comprehensive overview of the kinds of things that people need to be aware of. We offer that targeted to women because we know that in some cases women are intimidated by finances, but that's not always the case. So in some communities we offer it for everyone, men and women alike. That's kind of a local decision. How do they want to offer it? But in that program, one of the first things we do is we encourage people to start, if they haven't already, start thinking about what their goals are. And really make those goals as clear as they can. And as I work with folks on finances personally, I try to keep, and sometimes I get distracted, but I try to keep myself always coming back to what are their goals. Because if they are focused on their goals, then it will be worth it to them to make whatever changes they need. If they've got goals that they've identified that are really important,
mm-hmm.
then they'll want to make some changes.
And as Jonathan was saying, they will more likely have that self-control, that discipline to sticking to a plan.
It has to be worth it. It has to be worth it. And the other piece that we try to do, we try to keep it focused on their goals so that they can say, yeah, you know, I really would like to buy that ice cream cone, but if I don't, that's going to get me closer to my goal of new tires for my car or whatever.
Right. Okay.
And so we like to do that, and then we also like to instill some optimism. We like to make it practical and realistic so that they believe they can do it. You guys were just talking about the numbers people versus not so much numbers people. We try to present a variety of tools and methods that people can use to manage their money so that everyone will find something that will be comfortable to them, including people who really aren't into numbers.
Okay. Barb Wallen is with us, human sciences specialist in family finance at Iowa State University, also with Iowa State University Extension and Outreach. Jonathan Fox with us of ISU as well. A number of calls, emails, social media to get to. Let's do that right now. Steve is joining us from Ankeny. Hi, Steve. Do you have a personal story that we can learn from in finance?
Yes, I do. Thank you for taking my call. And I actually went to Iowa State. I probably would have benefited from some of these resources. When I graduated from ISU a few years, right around 2000, a few years later, I had built up substantial credit card debt, about $10,000. And my mom was very sick at the time. And when she passed away, she told me, now, I'm going to leave you some money, and I'm not going to tell you what you need to do with this money, but I really don't think you should have so much credit card debt. And she left me almost exactly the amount of my credit card debt, and I kind of got the hint. And I used that to pay off my credit cards, and since then I just have automatic withdrawal from my main account into a savings account, where I use that for kind of my fun money, and I don't carry any credit card debt anymore.
That sounds like a good story. So you had that wonderful opportunity to get out of the hole, the credit card mm-hmm. plastic debt hole in one fell swoop, and you learned a lesson.
Yes, I did.
All right, Steve, thanks for sharing. Steve in Ankeny dialed 1-866-780-9100. Jonathan Fox, I don't know if your research goes into credit history, credit, how we're doing in terms of our credit debt. Are we managing them better?
Well, some are, some aren't. I commend Steve for his decision and all that was he was coaxed to. Consistently say that far and away the best investment that we can make is paying off credit card debt, for example. It is a relatively high return, if not very high return, type of an investment with basically no variability. So
if you have $10,000 of credit card debt, you are paying what now? Something, what, 15, maybe more percent interest?
It's going to depend on the borrower and their characteristic and where you're borrowing from, but for sure it could be that high. But to get that as a guaranteed return, and what I'm implying here goes a little bit back to that habit formation discussion and how we can kind of think about credit, debt, and investing a little bit differently. If we think of paying off credit card debt as an actual investment, and an investment that certainly is going to beat the ride that is happening now and not have these ups and downs, then, as I said, I commend Steve for doing that. You asked a little bit about the research related to this, and I don't do a lot related to credit and debt, but in the little work that I have done, it in terms of improving our
credit debt or how we think about debt or whatever.
Exactly, in how we interact with the markets. Parents can play a pretty significant role here. And we've found some very, very interesting results relative to parenting styles and stricter parenting styles in terms of keeping us away from...
Is that better, stricter parents in terms of money, being a little bit overcautious?
When it comes to credit and debt, but not as much when it comes to more of the positive elements, which is actually a really, really interesting finding. So if we're trying to encourage our children to be really involved with the investment decisions or the purchasing decisions in the household, then more permissive style and involved style might make a lot of sense. But if it's something that might be a little bit more getting your hand burned on the stove, like accumulating credit card debt, then being a little bit more of taking a strict parenting style can actually help.
Okay. Jonathan Fox with us of Iowa State University and Barb Wallen. Fielding your questions about financial literacy. I think Conrad is joining us from Bettendorf. And Conrad, do you also have a personal story we can learn from?
I do. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Shortly after I graduated from Iowa State, coincidentally as well, I went into the Navy and had an income, but I also had bills coming in for the first time on the regular, and unfortunately, my lovely wife discovered one day when her cell phone didn't work, I was out to sea with the Navy, and the phone didn't work, and she couldn't get a hold of me. It was a mess. Thankfully, between that and having the power shut off on us as well, she taught me how to set up payments ahead of time so that we can avoid those problems.
Uh-huh.
And to this day, I don't understand how it didn't affect my credit score. I have no red flags or anything like that, so I must have rectified it fast enough. I don't know, but thanks for taking my call, and have a great day.
You too, Conrad in Bettendorf. Barb Wallen, perhaps this is a good opportunity to talk about your partner, your spouse, because that isn't always equal. Often in families, so one spouse or the other handles the finances, then maybe the pair breaks up or one spouse dies. That presents a problem.
Absolutely. It is not, it's not foolish for couples to specialize in what they're good at. You know, for the person who's good at cooking to cook, for the person who knows how to manage the car maintenance to do that. Likewise with money. It's not a mistake for that to happen, but the other side of that is that both partners really need to know more than they often do. So it's specializing is good, but everybody has to be in the loop and has to be involved in the decisions. So we have to know where things are. That's a simple thing in itself that many people don't know. And organizing files is a challenge sometimes as well. So we have to know where things are. We have to know what, for example, insurance coverage we have. But then also it helps to know why we have that coverage, why we made that choice, because maybe down the road the need will change. And someone will say, oh, well, I'm keeping that because that's what he always said I should have. Mm. But if the situation has changed, then, you know, it might be a foolish use of money at this point. So that equipping each other, and if one partner, those who are listening, if one partner is the strong one when it comes to money, then maybe it needs to be on you to help make sure you bring your partner along, mm-hmm. to make sure that they're at least equipped with some basics, and that the documents, some of your information is all organized well enough so that even if they forget some things, maybe you've left some notes behind. That's a real significant issue, making sure both people are well equipped.
Jonathan Fox, it sounds like you might want to get in there too on that item. About how to divide up finances, specialize in a family between partners and spouses?
No question at all. And goes back to, even at the beginning of this show, Bob talked about the importance when we're teaching our children, for example, about communication and involving them in the process. It can't be said any more simply and directly that the partnership and the couple won't always be a couple. One person's going to be left to manage the finances, and so that, and we don't know which one that's going to be.
Right.
So it's really important that both are at least minimally involved, or working with a really and truly trusted professional that's a true consumer advocate that's on their side. And on
okay,
the
I'm glad
side.
You mentioned that, because we were on that point a little bit earlier, seeking help, a financial planner. Well, there's one thing if you can't afford a financial planner, but how do you find an ethical financial planner? Because it is a world full of services, especially financial services that will be offered to you. Some good, well-meaning people behind those mm-hmm. services, others not so much. How do you find a good source of help?
Right. Well, we've talked a lot in this hour about things that we're not so good at, but I would contend that as individuals and as people, we're pretty darn good at sensing when someone is trustworthy. And that is the foremost and important issue. There are many, many compensation structures. There's many, many packages that financial advisors and financial planners come in. But the most important thing is that this person, you trust them, and that they truly are on your side. So oftentimes it's, you know, transparency of how they're being compensated. Their time is valuable. Their expertise took a large investment on their part to build up. So it's understood that they will be compensated. But, you know, part of that trust, I believe, comes from clearing the conflicts of interests and saying, this is how I'm being paid, whether it's by a commission or through a fee-only type of a model. There are outstanding planners that come in both packages, as I've said. Mm-hmm. I also firmly believe that having a rigorous designation, like being a certified financial planner, shows that they went to the effort to have a degree, have an education emphasis in the area. They were examined, they have experience, and they've, you know, consistent monitoring of ethical practices mm-hmm. in the area
okay.
as a starting point. But that trust indicator, using that radar that we all have, I believe in it, and I believe that it works.
Okay, Barb Wallen, we'll finish up. We have just a minute left. You wanted to jump in.
I would just add the importance of shopping around. We shop around like crazy for an $800 stove or refrigerator or that kind of stuff. We'll shop around all over the place. We forget to shop around for things like financial services, whether it's an insurance agent or a particular insurance policy or an investment advisor. And it's really smart to go to one, ask some questions, have an appointment, learn what you need to learn, go to another, go to a third. We tend to use the rule of three anytime we're talking about shopping around. So at least three different choices. You may feel ill-equipped to compare financial advisors. I'm not an expert. How can I decide? But if you go in and have some questions, and there are resources where you can find questions to ask, if you go in and have some questions and you get a sense of how that person answered, then you go off to the next one.
Okay. Barb, we don't have much time. Our music is there. What are the resources you would point people to?
We have a fact sheet that's part of an article at extension.org, which is the national extension website. So that's one resource you can turn to. You can always also turn to our website.
Okay. Barb Wallen of Iowa State University, Extension, Jonathan Fox of Iowa State University. Thank you both for being with us this hour.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Sean McLean helped us out in Ames. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.